Thanks for listening to The Kick-Ass Life with David Wood. Stay connected on Facebook, / The Kick-Ass Life, on Twitter, at The Kick-Ass Life, and, of course, at thekickasslife.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Joe Vitale, author of Attract Money Now. You're listening to The Kick-Ass Life Show with David Wood.
Life better?
This is the Kick-Ass Life Podcast with David Wood.
Well, good day. Welcome to the show again. I'm talking a little quietly right now because Jen's just having a little nap in the other room, so I just don't want to wake her up. But here we are, the last day in Australia, and what a trip it's been. It's just been an awesome time. And the last couple of days we've been here in Sydney, after our leadership event in the Hunter Valley region. And I've sort of got this swirling memories going around in my head from all of the incredible adventures we've been on and some of the incredible sights and, of course, the amazing people that we've met along the way. So many warm and wonderful things. And I just sort of, as I'm sitting here just preparing, we're going out for a farewell dinner. And we spent the afternoon on Bondi Beach watching the whales off in the distance. And there's a beautiful art walk. It's about 2 kilometers, and about every 50 yards or so, there's a different artist and just sort of expressing their creativity all the way along the ocean with the beautiful rocks and the crashing waves and the surfers and the sunshine. And so if you have a moment and you've never been to Bondi Beach, then just look it up. Go on Google and have a look, and you'll sort of get a picture of what it looks like. But this wonderful, maybe put in the word art alongside, and maybe you'll see the art that's there right now. I will post some photographs about it, but some incredible, incredible expressions of creativity. And of course, creativity is so wonderful because it's so different for all of us. And my guest this week is a different way of expressing his creativity, as he's been a comedian for over 20 years. And I know, you know, for someone who loves to stand up and tell jokes, and I did a stand-up comedy gig one time, which was, in essence, it was terrifying, except it went really well. And I didn't, when I look at great comedians, I always say great comedians sort of just poke fun at life and the sort of the normal stuff we do every single day. And of course, it's so funny how we are. And but I also think it must be an incredible challenge. I often think about even writing programs like I do, the creativity's there. But to write comedy and to keep reinventing that material, I have such deep respect. And of course, I mean, comedians, I often tell people who are sort of stepping out on this venture of a kick-ass life, I often say, you know, go to more comedy clubs, tell more jokes, you know, just sort of have more laughter. And whenever you can, stand up and tell a joke. We had a joke session the other night in an Irish pub in the Hunter Valley, and that's so neat, you know. It was, it wasn't in the pub. It was having dinner afterwards, after the pub. But it was just so neat to see people standing up. There was probably 28 of us in the room, and just, you know, taking in turns to tell jokes and step out and just hearing people belly laugh. And so I really have this deep affinity for comedy. And of course, you know, I've never had a comedian on the show yet, so it's actually interesting to have a comedian on the show. And this last week, he had one of his videos go viral on Facebook in regards to the election coming up and his philosophies on it. But what this guy's done, which is I find really, really fascinating, is kind of sort of at the pinnacle of the crossroads of personal development and comedy sits this guy. He's sort of bringing the two together based on a lot of his own life experiences, as you'll hear in the show, I'm sure, as he shares his life and, you know, how he found comedy. And but so as I'm sort of sitting here and about to embark on a flight home across the ocean, I find that's another thing I find staggering. I love flying. A lot of people complain and grumble about it. I love sort of jumping in this time capsule And, you know, people bring you food and drinks, and you can watch a movie, you can have a sleep, you can do some work, you can write a book, you can read a book, you can do whatever you want. You can sit and chat to some interesting people that are sitting next to you, and you sort of step out and you're in this whole other world, you know, and here I am a day ahead of you guys. So I'm coming back, leave here on Wednesday, come home, arrive home on Wednesday. I just find that fascinating. For those of you that don't know how to fly, and I say I don't know how to fly in the sweetest of senses, I mean that if you grumble about it or if you kind of like, you know, you get uptight, I really love observing people at airports because there's so much tension in people's bodies. Not everyone, but as someone who travels a lot, I always have these two rules. I know I've said them before, but I'll say them a number of times. I mean, try them. Last on, last off the plane. Be last on, last off the plane. I often wait, and most people who've traveled with me, they get really anxious because I normally wait till my name's called on the end, because they can't take off with your bags inside the plane, so they're going to call you anyway. And it's just so neat to walk on. The door closes right behind me, and I sit down, and suddenly the plane takes off. And the only person I met, Colin Powell, one time, and this is after he'd left office, and he was doing a personal development address, and I was there backstage with him, and he talked about that. He said, you know, the thing he missed most about about being in power like he was, right? Was, you know, the limousine would pull up at the private airplane, or, you know, what is it, Air Force One. He'd climb up the stairs, and, you know, the door would shut right behind him, and, you know, he'd sit down, and, you know, as a drink was thrust into his hand, and he could hear the second chunk of ice falling into the glass, those engines would roar, and he'd take off. And those are the things, you know, when he's, you know, going back to sort of walking out of his house and his wife saying, hey, don't forget the milk. There's that great saying, I don't know who said it, but before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. It's so true, man. It's all just a bunch of BS, right? I mean, we're all here. We're all human. We're all, you know, got our, you know, our crappy stuff and our great stuff and our hearts and our laughter. And so I want you to join me in this wonderful chat with my first comedian on the show. And I know he's had a very strong career. He was Comedy Central number one comedian in the big competition they had. So, you know, he's good at what he does. And I really like the fact that he really is committed to helping bring transformation of people's lives through comedy and personal growth. So just enjoy the chat I have with Mr. Carl Cease. So Kyle, I want to welcome you to the show, and I'm really excited because I get to interview and spend time with my first comedian. And I suppose, you know, when I think about comedy, I'm someone that laughs a lot. I love telling jokes. I use a lot of humor in my trainings, and it always fascinates me when somebody decides that one day they're going to be a comedian. I wonder if you can take me back to this journey. How does a guy start out and suddenly become a professional comedian?
Awesome. Well, thanks for having me, and thanks for saying that. It's actually really interesting. I never had a point in my life where I decided I'm going to be a comedian. And I think the reason was because I started so young that in my mind, I was already one. And in fact, I already considered myself to be somewhat famous in second grade class, and it's hilarious when I look back in my childhood how I was the class clown. And in second grade, I was basically I don't know if you remember the comedian Gallagher. He was the famous 80s comedian in America that smashed watermelons. I don't know if you've ever seen him, but he was really huge here. But my uncle worked for him and made all his props. He was kind of like a Carrot Top of the 80s, and he had all these giant toys and stuff. And my uncle designed all those things. So every year for Christmas, we'd get this comedian Gallagher's, you know, videos and all this stuff. And in second grade, my teacher told me during class that if I would be quiet, because I was just being really funny and telling, I'm sure, extremely brilliant jokes to the other second graders. My teacher told me during class, she said, if you be quiet, I'll give you 5 minutes at the end of the week to do whatever you want. And I just remember, you know, loving Gallagher and doing his material, which was really funny because I was talking about sex and taxes to second graders. I didn't even get what I was talking about. and, you know, with a Southern accent, too. I assumed every comedian had a Southern accent because he did. So I'd be like going, women, you go out shopping, you buy us underwear that fits cardboard. Am I right, guy? It was just absolutely surreal. And I didn't realize until I was probably 25 how weird that was. You know, when I look back on it now, that's what I was doing. And then I would negotiate with teachers in the years after that I'll be good if they'd give me, you know, a certain amount of time to do material. And around sixth grade, I started writing my own stuff and doing jokes on things like recess or whatever. And then at 12, I it was weird. It was never a moment, like, it almost drove me crazy when people said to me when I was a kid, one day maybe you'll be a famous comedian. Cause I'd be sitting there going, look, dude, I like the school paper's already done a story on me. Like I've signed everyone's, I didn't understand what they meant, that I will be. I was already there. It never occurred to me that there's somewhere to reach for because I was already at the top. And I think that mentality propelled me much faster, because I think that if we're thinking to ourselves, one day I'm going to be famous, we're implying out loud to ourselves that we're not now. And we move from a day one perspective versus an already there perspective. And often we keep moving that way, and we keep stating out loud, one day I'm going to be famous. So we're saying one day is not now, and continually saying I'm not there. And I think that's a big thing that I've seen with visualizing, is we always picture the thing coming up in the future versus that it already happened. And
can I take you back though? Because I know that as a young kid, you probably weren't as clear on what you're articulating now. Is you know, you're coming from a perspective of you know, becoming a professional comedian and working like you do in personal growth. But back then, were you that clear? Did you know? Was it your mother's influence or who surrounded you that you had this confidence to say, "Hey, I'm already at the top. I'm already where I want to be." I mean, that's a pretty astute and a confident kind of perspective for a young kid. Where did that come from? Where did that belief and confidence come from so young?
I think, you know what, it's funny because I think I've done the whole math and traced down my entire story. I think when I was a little kid, my mom said that when I was 4 months old, I hummed This Old Man, like the childhood song. I hummed it exactly on tune and in the same notes as a toy that I had that was playing it. And so my mom was so proud of me and so excited about that, that she would tell everybody about it. And so she would go, you guys got to watch this. And I started, of course I didn't understand the linking I was making then, but I basically could tell that I got love for being entertaining. And my dad, as I said, the uncle worked for that comedian. My dad's mom, my grandma, was actually also on the Carol Burnett show too. And not that that necessarily influenced me too much, but it did give me this confidence that, and this total unconscious understanding that this is absolutely easy to do. This is something you do. This is just, you can completely do this. And so I also have always discovered, and without being able to articulate this too, that I can't believe how many rules there were. Like, I was just having so much fun my whole childhood. And you know, there were some hard times. Like, I was the chubby kid in high school and in junior high, and when I was funny, it was a weapon to get everyone to like me, you know? And so I just had a blast in my whole childhood being like the funny kid. And I think that it just continually, I wanted to impress my mom more and more and more. So I started, you know, doing comedy clubs and impressing people around me. And then eventually, next thing I know, I was a comedian in clubs around, between 12 and 15 years old.
It's funny you just said what you said, because it was a question that sort of popped in my mind a moment ago and I dismissed it, but I'm going to sort of dig into that a little bit more right now.
Sure.
I know myself, you know, I used humor a lot to, you know, to kind of quiet. My mom was a bit of a rager, right? And she'd go into these kind of tirades and, you know, she was going through a lot of stuff. So I found that comedy for me was this thing that I could, you know, I could kind of keep the peace at home. So I used it as a weapon, and use that right now. You know, you were a chubby kid who, you know, when you were funny, it sort of, you know, it allowed you to sort of get into groups that maybe you couldn't get into. Do you find out, like, a lot of comedians, I know you and I had a quick chat last night and you talked about often comedians have a negative spin to them, where a lot of what you do is a very positive spin, which is quite a paradox really. But do you find that a lot of comedians are, they sort of grow from that weapon? Do you think that's a reason why a lot of people get into comedy in the beginning when they're young?
Yeah, I think you have to ask yourself why, you know, we want 300 strangers a night to love us so much. And I think that, and I mean that in a cool way, it's a cool thing to do too. But I mean, comedy is a defense. You know, I know many people that, I know a person who's a comedian who's very overweight. And if you want to help him and you go, hey, you know, you got this thing, he'll just throw a joke at you and you laugh, and then the subject's changed and we never actually address the issue. And that goes by for years eventually. And it's this place that's funny and it's very fun. And I've noticed that in the comedy scene, there are some comics that absolutely have made it and proven that you can do anything still with comedy. I think the comedian Louis C.K. is doing that right now, and Ellen DeGeneres sure did it, and there's a lot of great comics. There's also about 100,000 comedians going up at open mics and different clubs that are doing a lot of the same stuff, and they're very angry, and they think that, you know, life is a joke. And so they go up and talk about that a lot. And I'm not saying that I at all have any judgment for it, but I just notice myself going, this is not where I belong at all. And it's not how I feel. And so I definitely went through, and I'm still at times going through, a split in my mind where I accidentally think that comedy and positivity are two separate worlds, but they're not. But we have definitely created two giant groups of comics that are very dark and angry, or also just people in the world that are very dark and angry, and then this other breed of people that are extremely positive, but they're not authentic. And there's a great group of people that are in between that are trying to find that combination. But I find that a lot of people don't change themselves when they get into spirituality. They change the show. You know, and I don't mean this knocking it, but they change the appearance, they change the story, and they start telling everybody their name is Rainbow Maka Sunshine, and they don't shave their armpits anymore. And I'm like, well, you're still, I don't know that that's spiritual. You just are now staring at me longer. You know those people that stare at you for 10 minutes while you're talking, and then they want you to notice that they're staring at you, and it's just like, I hear you, and you realize they didn't hear you at all. They just want you to notice how good they've gotten at staring.
So if we look at this, though, I mean, because I think this is a really good, it's a great place or a great awareness you have, this idea of authenticity, which I've heard that come out of your mouth. Again, we don't know each other very well. We're just sort of starting out our relationship together. And you know, but you use the word authenticity a lot, and this idea that you show up in your show kind of as you are. And that's right. A rare thing, because I mean, I train a lot of trainers, and one of the things that is the hardest thing for me to get across to people is when you show up kind of completely as you are, completely authentically, that's when the magic really starts to happen. That's when you really start to have that connection with the audience. Do you find the same thing with comedy? I mean, is this kind of a new breed of comedy, or has this been around for years? Is the most successful comics been more authentic, or are they hiding their authenticity? And how?
Absolutely.
Let me know. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that if you're going on stage, let's say you're going on stage and you're nervous, just say you're nervous. Like, that's the thought going through your brain. And the second you say you're nervous, that releases this tension, and the audience can connect with you and think of when they're nervous and actually sympathize with you. The big problem we have is that's what we're thinking all the time. And when we present something on stage or in a video or something like that, we make the mistake of thinking that we are our content. So we work really hard on saying something specific that we're going to say on stage, and we practice it over and over, but we don't realize that what we're doing is spending all day practicing, but we're not practicing presenting. We're not practicing being in the moment and understanding that life is living in this moment. And when you play all day and then at night, if you go and do a presentation, understand that the stage just makes you 2 feet higher. And it's not some moment that's more important than the moment before that. And all day, you know, people I watch, if they're about to perform or do a speech, they pace back and forth with a nervousness, and they're in their head, and they don't realize they're even creating nerves in that moment. And they think that they're getting rid of their nerves, but they're creating them. They're looking into the future. They're ignoring the moment they're in. And they're saying, in the future, this thing that I have is really important. And then you have to ask yourself, why is that performance or that speech so much more important than, you know, right now at noon or whatever? The reason is because you want to do something where you want to sell something or you want to get a presentation out and get that audience to like you. And if you want to get people to like you, you're saying out loud to yourself that you are in lack without those people. So because of that, you put yourself in an incompleteness. And that's why we can spend 23 hours a day playing all day, having a good time, talking to people, being in the moment. And then we have that 1 hour, which is the hour that we want to bring that same moment that we were in all day onto the stage. And we don't, because we associate it as a thing that we need to complete ourselves. And instead of just bringing in your authenticity and being true to how you feel, I have gone on stage. I did my one hour Comedy Central special without planning it. I literally played all day and went on stage and brought the real me on. And it was the most freeing thing. It took no extra work. It wasn't this long strain thing. I mean, of course I had some things I knew I wanted to say, but I didn't have the order down of how I was going to say it. And here's why that was so beautiful. If someone screamed something out in the audience, I could go with it. But if I had this list of rules of how everything needed to be, that wouldn't be authentic to what's happening in that moment. And I would have sat there and been frustrated or stressed that things didn't go the way I had decided that they should have gone. And so that's the type of authenticity that people are missing out on. And it's ironic when I see speakers teaching sometimes that authenticity and then, you know, saying things like, I have another seminar, I only have 10 seats left, you know, and saying tricks that are, I need you to come buy my stuff, versus really just being authentic and being so good that people undeniably will just as a byproduct want to buy your stuff, you know, or if they don't, you aren't stressed about it, because if you truly believe that, quote, there's a universe that has you, then that's supposed to be. And your stress won't show up.
Well, let me ask you a question, though, because if we talk about this with sort of the stage in mind, that's one thing. But for me, authenticity, I find a lot of people walk through life where they're not really showing up. They're not really in the moment. They're not really present. They wear masks at work. They wear masks, you know, with certain friends. They wear masks at the bank manager. So actually the real person showing up is not something they're used to. So when we look at your analogy, which I like, and I totally subscribe to the fact that, you know, this idea of not being present, and when we're in that present moment, that really, again, that magic happens. But do you find then, sort of through life in your observation of humanity, and you have this kind of thing, which we haven't even introduced yet, where personal growth meets comedy or comedy meets personal growth. You've really sort of crossed over both barriers. And that's why I'm fascinated by what you're doing. But do you notice that with people in life, that they're really living life where they're not really showing up into the moment and they're sort of living a script? And how do you see that? How do you observe humanity as a whole, as opposed to just comedians or trainers or speakers?
It's funny you say that, because when I mention the stage, that's a byproduct of life, and it's just a side point, and I know exactly what you mean. In fact, the most recent thing I was talking about on stage was how we all the time are phony. Like, I believe all day, if you really just these moments where we can't just have silence or we can't say anything progressive, we just need to talk about nothing. Sometimes even saying, how are you, is phony. You know what I mean? How are you doing? It's just a thing that we feel required to say sometimes to get to the next thing. And then when they say fine, they're lying. You know, they could have had something really bad happen. So we start off almost every conversation lying, like absolutely phony to each other. And sometimes you can really listen and find they were lying as they say, oh, I'm really good. And then they talk, and then 2 minutes later, they're like, yeah, my brother's really sick and everything. You want to be like, wait a minute, what's all this good stuff you just said? You want to call them out, because there is a true authenticity that I find is not there at all. And I think we're almost not being authentic when we're analyzing, and when we're just in the future trying to figure out how something will be. We're not in this moment just saying I'm confused, you know, or I'm lost, or just admitting that. We're trying to control something and trying to make it better and trying to fix something, versus just allowing and saying I'm allowing. And yeah, I think people are scared to just say, you know what, I got a problem here, or I'm scared. And we're so busy trying to mask that and not be authentic all day. And what's really weird is, having searched for it so deeply, you know, I feel it a lot with people instantly. And I don't say it with judgment. I sure know that I have a ways to go, but you can still feel it when people are like that, you know, and you feel just a need for to be loved, or you feel a need to, you know, prove a point. And you just want to be like, dude, you're good as it is. Everything's cool.
So again, if you go through this journey, I mean, you've sort of found yourself right now. You've been recently working with Jim Carrey and Bob Proctor, Eckhart Tolle, and Michael Beckwith, and all these different great leaders in the world of human development. And that's kind of a funny, or it would seem not funny, but an unusual destiny for a comic. So a comic starting out, obviously you have these deep philosophical kind of ideas about humanity, and this extreme confidence is sort of woven through your life. And here you find yourself at a sort of a crossroads where you say comedy and personal growth, personal development, personal transformation. I'm not sure of your specific term for it, where sort of these doors have opened where you're really working with some of these really inspired thought leaders in the world. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that crossover, and why, how did you find yourself in that situation with those types of people?
Well, actually the reason is because I was doing comedy for, you know, at one point I had been doing comedy maybe 15 years or so, around 2004. So I think it was 26 or 27. I was touring so much. I had done two big teen movies, 10 Things I Hate About You and Not Another Teen Movie. I was booking colleges. I ended up doing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of colleges in my 20s. And I literally spent every day flying to each college. I would sometimes do 2 to 3 flights a day trying to get to the next college. And at one point I did 68 colleges in a row. I was living on drive-through. I didn't get any sleep. And I was just, you know, getting to the next gig and then trying to get to the gig after that, and dealing with, you know, flights not making it and all kinds of stuff. And I did this for, at one point I did a 3-month tour where I did 68 colleges in a row. And at the end of it, I ended up with pneumonia. I almost died. I was hospitalized on the road. And in 2005, I had this thing happen where I was so able to do my act that I basically had mastered doing an hour and a half of stand-up and pulling off a standing ovation. And what happened at that point was, I got comfortable. And when you get comfortable, you don't create. And if you don't keep, so I wasn't creating new material or evolving myself. And I really believe that if you don't create, your mind will start to creatively sabotage you out of boredom. So if you take the combination of the lack of blood flow from the exhaustion of the drive-through and everything, plus the stagnation of myself, I was going on getting standing ovations, but I wasn't moving. I just one day out of exhaustion was on stage and I was performing, and out of nowhere I started thinking to myself a thought. I just thought, while I was in the middle of my act, I thought to myself something totally different. I thought, I wonder if you could think about it enough if you could make yourself faint. And that was a thought I had. And right when I thought that, I remember looking at my hand and I started almost whiting out. And it made me suddenly believe, oh my goodness. And I had two thoughts. I can't not think about something, right? And that my mind will strategically keep thinking I'm going to make myself faint until I do it and I ruin my career. And the other belief I had about myself was, the only person I am is a comedian. I mean, I'm a chubby kid in high school. I suddenly book some teen movies and everybody loves me. So up until this moment, those were the only things I had to survive. I believe we constantly do that. And so I sat there and thought, if I do this, I'm going to faint while I'm on stage. Because I was on stage and I thought to myself, I basically linked this fear to the stage. And so I started actually creating an anxiety on the stage where I actually created a stage fright. And if I have a stage fright, then I'm not worth anything. So this brought me to a point of thinking about suicide. I literally would want to go on, I'd be about to go on stage every night, and I would sabotage myself all day and think I'm going to faint when I'm on stage and that'll make me ruin my career. And I got really scared of both fainting and ruining my career. And while I was at the height of it, I booked my first Comedy Central appearance with 3 months notice. And my manager said, don't blow it. So I had 3 months to figure out, basically I had 3 months that I just thought to myself, I'm going to faint when I'm on this show. and it got so bad. This is why a lot of artists get into drugs so much, because they have some giant 7-minute appearance coming up in 3 or 4 months that they have to make perfect, because their whole career and their whole life and their next album revolves around it. So they put so much pressure on themselves on how to structure and make that 7-minute or that 10-minute or half an hour thing good, that they scare themselves. And the only thing that can get them in the moment at that point in their mind is drugs. So I got really bad. I got close to suicide. And then actually what happened was I did the taping on Comedy Central, and I didn't faint, but I was really close. And they gave me a half hour special after that. And I was like, okay, I don't want to go through this again. So I picked up a Tony Robbins book. And one of the things it said was, you know, you can't think of two things at the same time. And I started to think to myself, the reason my mind got so deep and so bad was because it wanted a challenge, and I wasn't giving it anything exciting. I wasn't giving it any growth. So I need to give my mind something really challenging that's really positive. So I said, what if I have the number one Comedy Central special? How can I have the number one Comedy Central special? Which was at that time ridiculous, because there were enormous comics. But when I pictured it, my mind started going that route instead. And I started picturing, you know, well, what if you woke up every morning at 6 a.m. and jumped around the house and had fun, and you started writing all day and recording everything? And immediately I started doing it. I did what I called taking my mind to the gym. Every single morning at 6 a.m., I'd wake up and I'd jump out of bed. And I, even with the anxiety, I would be all excited. And at one point, very, very early on, the anxiety started going away. And I started catching something way bigger, that I had the ability to steer and control what I think about and what happens to me and my emotions. And so I went from suicidal anxiety to number one Comedy Central special in 3 months. And I lost 80 pounds at the same time. I got out of a bad relationship, and suddenly my whole life turned around. And it had nothing to do with the special being number one. It had to do with my understanding of my ability. And I went through this first stage for a few years of needing everyone to know this is possible and me testing it out all day, and going from, you know, changing my body to changing my, you know, thinking, to going, having another number one special, and really using this all the time. And so my awareness of what we could do became so unbelievable, and I needed everybody to know it. And so I realized I'm talking about this. And then I suddenly stopped being funny, because I was talking about that so much. And I realized, you know, at one point, how do we combine these? And it was a big deal, you know? So that's kind of the opening to it. And
I just want to ask you a question in there, because this fascinates me. So here you are, this comedian who has been funny a lot of your life, who finds yourself in this kind of like this completely negative thought spiral. And that negative thought spiral is showing up in a physical kind of manifestation with you, you know, fear of fainting, this fear of the stage, the anxiety, the pressure, the tension. It's all building up in your body to the point where you start to question whether you should be alive or not. And then you read one thing. And this is the thing, I think, because, you know, when people listen to this show, if they take one thing away from them, they may not be suicidal. They may not be at the end of their rope. But I think a lot of people are walking around knowing there's more that they want out of the life, knowing that there is something else to be had. And you were able to take one concept that you read in a book and completely transform your life in a matter of months. And how long ago was that, by the way? Can you give me a sort of a time frame? How long ago that happened?
I believe that special came out in 2006. So I recorded it in 2005, around August or September 2005, and it came out January 2006. And so,
you've maintained this positive outlook at life, this success that you've enjoyed, your physical body. I mean, nothing's gone back. I mean, you've continued moving forward from this moment of despair all the way through now into this kind of this success cycle that you enjoy, right? I mean, you didn't go back to suicidal thoughts. It's not like this ebb and flow, right?
Well, here's the funny thing, is that what happened to me was the underlying thing that I understood from this was, every time I have a problem, I'm about to become a superhero. Like, I'm about to learn something enormous. And so I actually, bizarrely, get really excited when I have problems. I mean, seriously, like, I'm excited all the time, but when I have a problem, I go, what is going to happen to me? And that underlying thought, or what can I do with this? How can I use this? What does this mean? What does this mean for me? And so, yeah, that's not, and it's funny because it wasn't even about me becoming more positive. It's like, oh, I saw the Matrix. It's like, once, you know, in the movie The Matrix, once he saw it, it's not like he can go back and slip in there. He understands that everyone is a digital image in front of him and they're not real. He's in a computer program. And that's what I experienced. I actually completely got the concept of that I am, you know, not my emotions, that they are a collection of stories, they're an illusion, that my identity is not any label, like I'm a comedian or I'm a positive speaker or any of that stuff. I'm seeking the truth. That's all I'm doing, and I'm doing it out loud. And sometimes it's funny and sometimes it's inspirational. And that's all we're here to do. And I think you're the greatest if you're just seeking what your truth and your authenticity is. And yeah, I actually, here's how good that went. In 2009, Comedy Central put out their 100 favorite comedians. Now, I know that you're in all kinds of different countries, and in America, Comedy Central is a very big channel, and the comedians on it are very big. Some of them are household names. And so Comedy Central put out their 100 favorite comedians, and they asked the public to vote on who their favorite comedian is. And then in a month, they would, you know, announce who the number one comic is based on the audience voting. So every comedian, many of them had millions and millions of followers. They were doing stadiums. They put out to their lists, you know, vote for me in the contest. Well, another thing I had learned from a Tony Robbins event was to change the question from can I to how can I? Because when you say can I, you get yes or no. If you say how can I, your mind, like Google, it comes up with a list of ways to do it. So 2 weeks into the contest, with 2 weeks left, I just asked myself, how can I win this thing? And right when I asked that, immediately my mind said, what if you did like a little podcast and you thanked everybody who voted for you by name? So I announced that I'm going to do that on my Facebook. And the next morning I did like a 10-minute motivational thing. And then I thanked 400 names that had emailed me that said they'd vote for me. And right when I thanked 400 names, I jumped from 18th to 8th place with 2 weeks left in the contest. So I announced I'm going to do this again the next day. And those people all brought their friends in. So the next day I thanked 800 names and I jumped to 7th place. And then the next day I jumped to 6th place, thanking 1,600 names. And it just kept pretty much around doubling every single day. And it got to the last week. And it was myself against a very famous ventriloquist out here named Jeff Dunham. He has like 300 million combined YouTube views, and he had a TV show coming out. So I'm in the last week in second place. He has 100,000 more votes than me. And Comedy Central wanted him to win because they had a TV show coming out with him. So they put out 16 of his hour specials that week and none of mine. And every commercial break on Comedy Central said, vote for Jeff Dunham. That was, and my fans were all worried, but to me, that was the first moment of my life that I realized I am so powerful by changing my thinking that I've just changed national television programming. So my fans were worried, and then I actually took another quote of the Tony Robbins and told them, and now I have my own philosophies and stuff, but at the time I was really just, you know, learning how to do this, so I was using these things. But he said, this isn't a problem. It's a test to see how bad you want it. And I started believing that. Everything in our life is a test to see how bad you want it. And so in the last week, I said, let's go. How bad do we want it? And my fans voted like crazy. And on the last day, they announce who won. And they announced by playing the specials of Comedy Central Comics 20 down to 1. And at one point, I got a call from the East Coast that Jeff Dunham was in second place, and I had won the entire contest with 238,000 votes in 2 weeks. And I suddenly got even more that this, I mean, it was just the most fun week of breakthroughs and understanding that we can do anything if we want it. We really actually can. And it's frustrating when you see someone who sits there and says they want something and shoots themselves down of why they can't have it. I mean, it's just ridiculous looking.
But there's two parts to your story, which it fascinate me, is this idea that, first of all, you really are the master of your thinking, and that's what's really changed your life around from, again, I want to go back to that moment of despair where suicide that's a huge thing when you start thinking about taking your life. And then to this point now where, you know, and that's a big deal. You know, you're competing against the top comics in the world, and you have this 2-week window. But you did something else. You took this massive action, and you came up with an action plan, and with this constant belief system again, where you're managing your thoughts in conjunction with that action, and that fascinates me. So I want to leap forward, because I want to say that right now I know that you shared with me yesterday, and you haven't shared much about this. So I'm fascinated from my own sort of thought process, is that, you know, Jim Carrey and Eckhart Tolle have got together in combination, I believe, to do, there's a certain philosophy they have, and you've been invited in to work with them. And a lot of people, if they don't know Jim Carrey's story, I know Jim went through some real devastation early on in his life, you know, but he also had this strong mindset when he wrote the check for, I think it was $20 million that he threw into his dad's grave. And he's, you know, he kind of visualized that he was going to be the highest paid comedian, which actually came to fruition. But I think that part of the reason he became such a success, if I have the story correctly, is that, you know, he really bombed in the beginning. You know, he went on stage, he was a complete fluke, you know, he locked himself in a room, and he really worked on his gestures and his all these different things. So, you know, he has a tremendous global following. And of course, Eckhart Tolle, the same thing, is this sort of very deep spiritual. And it's kind of a bit of a paradox of a unity, if you say Jim Carrey, Eckhart Tolle. But then they come to you and they say, hey, come work with us. Can you tell us what that's all about and you know, how you got there and what that means to you to be a part of that kind of group?
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny because this show that was Jim Carrey and Eckhart Tolle, I mean, if you could ask me 3 years ago what would be a dream gig for me, I would think that this was not possible. I mean, you would literally, it sounds like a dream for me. Like, well, it'd be like if I was like, well, if you could, this sounds crazy, but if you could get Jim Carrey and Eckhart Tolle in a room together, I mean, that's like saying, you know, Billy Joel and Steve Martin have a gig. Those are two other favorites of mine. You know, can we get those guys together? And it just doesn't happen because there's such different worlds. But they aren't, in a way, too. I mean, if you really think about it, Jim Carrey is about only having fun and being free. If you watch Jim Carrey, he has no boundaries. His comedy is freedom. His comedy is being a 5-year-old. And that's what Eckhart Tolle is teaching you how to do too, how to let go and stop planning and live in the moment and really enjoy life. So that combination completely makes sense. And they with another gentleman named John Rotz, created a company called GATE. It stands for Global Alliance of Transformational Entertainers. And that company basically has a goal to raise awareness and shift the consciousness of the media. Because, you know, I think all of us are aware that...
Well, whoops. How about that? I suppose that's what happens when you're... about to jump on a plane and do a transcontinental flight back to Canada. So I'm sorry about the end of the program there, just cutting Kyle off. But I'm sure you got the juice and the nuggets from the show. And I'm excited. I'm excited about to jump on a plane and make it back across the ocean there after 3 weeks on the trip. And I'm really excited about seeing my kids. In fact, I just posted a photograph on... my Facebook page, The Kick-Ass Life. See, Calvin is actually the same height as me in the photograph. He's kind of got one leg bent, but he's actually looking me right in the eye. It's incredible. It's incredible how fast it goes, but I'm excited. When I get home, we've got a 19-day trip planned to Belize, and they're going to be coming down to help me with a program and actually take the program. I'm doing the same program 2 weeks in a row. But anyway, I do apologize for the technical glitch, but on this short notice, as I'm running to the plane, I may even miss it if I carry on yakking here. I hope that you can live with that. I'm sure you can. Don't forget to go to kylecease.com. That's K-Y-L-E-C-E-A-S-E. That's sort of the C, Charlie, Echo, Alpha, Sierra, Echo, com. And you can find out about his upcoming program as well, which is in November, November 29th through December 1st in Las Vegas, Nevada. So yeah, check it out. Again, really grateful that you're listening in all the time, and the numbers are really starting to move. And I love this map. I have a map of the world, and everywhere the show is shown, it's all in blue where the show is and white where it isn't. And there's just a few spots in the entire world where the show isn't being shown. And the more downloads there are in a particular country, the darker the blue gets. So it's such a great visual because I can look at it in a millisecond and see where the penetration is and where people are really downloading a lot. So, you know, it doesn't matter whether you've listened to one show or 10 shows or whether you've listened to all 50 or 50, almost 60 now. I really want to thank you. And I'm really excited about this this coming sort of season, if I like to call it that, these next 3 months, as I know that we're sort of starting to get the wheels under this thing and understand it a little bit more. And because of that, we can take it to another level. So looking forward to your input. Don't forget, you know, go to Facebook, have a chat, the Kick-Ass Life Facebook page, and let us know what you're thinking, and share what's going on for you. Share the wins you're having, the victories you're having, the things that you're applying to your life, that's important as well. And really the stuff that's working for you, because obviously with so many amazing guests, there are so many, it could be one tiny thing can change everything. Anyway, we'll see you on the other side, and I'm running to the airport. Ciao!
That was kick-ass.